I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today, I'm so excited to have on the podcast Rob Bell. Yep, that Rob Bell. And John Lustria is with me as well. I'm excited that John's along. Hey, John.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Hey, Rob, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
And for those unfamiliar with Rob, which is kind of hard for me to believe if you've been in faith circles in the last, I don't know how many years, but number of years, Rob is a New York Times bestselling author, and I am most excited to talk with him about his latest book. It's just coming out, actually, May 16, I think, is the date. Is that right, Rob?
That is.
All right, release date. That's cool. And it's called What is the Bible? How an Ancient Library of Poems, Letters, and Stories Can Transform the Way You Think and Feel About Everything. And I think that's...
It's a great subtitle.
Yeah, it is. And I'm curious, why a book about the Bible now? Why this book? Why now?
Well, I mean, these poems, letters, and stories have transformed the way I think and feel about everything.
It pretty much says it.
There was two things I was trying to do, which was to make the longest subtitle in the history of writing, and then secondly, to try and convey how powerful, poetic, dangerous, provocative these books are. And what I kept noticing, because my work, I'm not in like really religious or church settings, and yet people love to talk about the Bible. And it's my friends who actually have no sort of religious or whatever background. They're the ones who are like, dude, that stuff you do on the Bible, you like should write that up.
Right.
And it was how unexpected. And my observation would simply be that most people are missing it. You have one group that's like, if it says it, then it actually happened exactly like that. And the other one says, there's no way you actually believe that happened. And both groups are actually fundamentalists. And they're both actually missing the power and poetry of the thing. So that's where it comes from.
One of my questions to you, too, it seems to me, and I've been listening to your podcast for a while as well. John has, too. But it seems like your enthusiasm for the Bible has... maybe, well, is as high or higher than ever. Is that accurate?
That's probably, that's actually true. That's true. It actually has more to say. When you understand it as a human book written by real people in real places in real times, then you realize, they're talking about what everybody's talking about now. And for many people, the Bible is nice ideas, and then you believe the right stuff and go somewhere else when you die. But that wasn't the pressing concern of the writers of the Bible. They were talking about politics. They were talking about inequality between rich and poor. They were talking about, obviously, a proper relationship with the soil. And for them, a proper relationship with the physical environment. If you don't have that, your political, economic, social, religious structures all fall apart. So lots of ideas that are considered progressive are there on page one of the Bible. It was way ahead thousands of years ago.
Well, as a historian, I can appreciate that. So I have now 2 degrees in history as of like a couple days ago. Thank you. But I appreciate whenever people help other people to realize that there's very little that is new. Like there's all sorts of ideas that have been circulating for a long time. And that's one thing I appreciated about this. But something, when you brought this up, and you say it many times in the book, is that it's very important that the Bible should be viewed as a profoundly human book. Why is it so important in your mind that people view it that way?
Well, you think about the Bible, it's as much about the absence of the divine as it is the presence of the divine. Like the Gospel of Matthew, after Jesus' resurrection, Matthew wants you to know some of his followers doubted.
Right.
Like, what's that? That is crap propaganda. That is, if you're trying to make a case, why would you at the last minute be like, oh, by the way, a bunch of his closest followers were like, yeah, I don't know if I buy it. So you can either let that completely undermine it, or you can say, oh, this is actually profound insight into what it means to be human. Sometimes you have great surety, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you're certain, sometimes you're not. There's the known and the unknown. There's belief and there's doubt. And we're all a mix of all of this. And I think that's right, like the Book of Lamentations, a collection of poems in the middle of the Hebrew Scriptures. Essentially, God's nowhere to be found. They're sitting in the midst of trouble going, what? How did... It's the pause after the atomic bomb. I mean, it is the, where do we go from here? And these are the depths of human sorrow, joy, long loss, love, euphoria, betrayal. And that's why I think it's so important is to know that you're not alone and that people have before.
Yeah, well, and in one of the book trailers you did for this book where you parodied yourself, which was incredibly entertaining, by the way, when you made the point that religion has hijacked the Bible, focusing on the humanity of the book makes it that much more relatable, whereas, you know, making it a book that's always talking about God while nice in plenty of ways is a lot harder for a person to relate to a divine being than a person to relate to another person.
Sure. And when people in the Bible use the word God, and there's lots of different names, even people should know, there's lots of different names. The first name that's even used to try and describe God in the Bible is Elohim, which is a plural word.
I'll never forget when that revelation first was made known to me. It's like, oh, you mean when it says God in the Bible, it's not always the same word? And that blew my mind when I first saw
that. Right. So essentially, if you think about the word God, is human beings trying to give language to the infinite, trying to give language to the ground of our being, to issues of ultimate concern. Essentially, you could even say, maybe nowadays people would say, what kind of universe are we living in? Might be how the word God could be translated. What's behind it all? What's under it all? And then when you realize, oh, this was an ongoing discussion in the Bible. Are the gods angry? Are the gods interested in joy? Is there one God? Does God dwell in statues and temples? Does God present in our midst? Are we gods? How does this work? Which are the questions we're asking today? Like, who's in charge here? When you get cancer, is the universe a safe place? When you go through a brutal divorce, is the universe on my side? Like, these are all the same issues. And if you can move, like you said, past the language to why people were talking about this, suddenly you have a very, very compelling set of books.
Yeah, and so when you kind of start from the beginning, as it were, with, you know, is there a God? And then what, you know, the next follow-up question, or at least as I think about it, is what is the nature of the divine or whatever? And so the Bible, I guess, is just one long answer to that question, what the nature of the divine is.
Yeah, and it's almost like the Bible writers are going, well, I'm taking a shot at it, but of
course, right.
Figuring it out. Or like, I love it when Jesus, there's this line from Jesus, says to his disciples, you'll do greater things than these. Wait. What? Excuse me? I often wonder if Jesus could listen, if Jesus was giving modern commentary, would he be like, wait, you're still talking about what I did when what I talked about is what you will do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The idea was I would pass it to you and then you would take it somewhere.
Right.
Which makes me think about how we even read the Bible. I mean, I think that what I appreciate about what you're writing is helping us to engage with the Bible in a different way. One of the things you talk about is the fact that we ask the wrong questions all the time. We don't even come to this book or this series of books asking the right questions. And I'd love for you to, talk a little bit about the wrong questions versus, you know, what are those questions that are a lot more helpful?
I always try to frame it in terms of possibilities.
Yeah.
So I try to avoid, like, nobody gets it. I try to begin with, here's the reason why, perhaps, sometimes way people approach the Bible. If people begin with, why did God do it that way? you didn't get a book that dropped out of the sky in a glass box. What you got is a fascinating blend of history mixed with poetry, and poetry mixed with history, and letters, and fables, and parables, and poems. And so if you begin with, why did people write this down? And a lot of it was oral tradition. So why did this particular story around the campfire have such enduring resonance that it made it through the playoffs? Like, it survived, in some sense. Do you know what I mean? It somehow around the campfire was like, wait, tell that one again. That it got written down, and then thousands of years later, it has endured. So what was happening in the world at that time? Why did people find this helpful, a warning, provocative, dangerous, unsettling? If you ask those sorts of questions, and not only why would people have written this down, but then second question, why did it endure? You now have just a totally different discussion. And a lot of things that people debate and discuss become irrelevant. Like, that's not... because you're now asking the kind of questions that you actually might get to the heart of something really interesting there. So that's always, I think, where you start, is you start with the book that you actually have. And where did it come from? What was life like in Mesopotamia? Were there other flood stories, which there were? David and Goliath's story is about technology. The Philistines have a new kind of metal. What do you do when only a few nations have an atomic bomb and others don't? Oh, my word. Now we're talking about 2017. That's like your one sentence, and all of a sudden we're talking about now. What do you do when your neighbor has a weapon that you don't have? That's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Look at her.
I'm pointing at you, John. John, you go.
Speechless. Oh, yes. I agree, or I concur, as they say in university.
I want to know how you decide. Okay, John, go. You go.
Yes, I finally remembered the...
Cool. Mom is on a roll there.
Yeah, well, I finally remembered the follow-up I had. Well, so one of the questions that's helpful to ask is, you know, what was going on in first century Mesopotamia? And as a historian, I love footnotes to things, and you included a very helpful bibliography, annotated bibliography, which I enjoyed reading through. But a lot of people, you know, like, there are parts, you know, in the book where you say, well, if you dig just beneath the surface and we really dig into this, what this Greek word or this Hebrew word means, most people don't understand Greek or Hebrew. So what would you say are some good places they can go to?
They can also tell you everything that happened in the third episode, season 2 of Game of Thrones. So,
exactly. We'll
at length discuss season 3 of House of Cards and what happened and when it happened and the subtleties and the nuances. So we are very, very capable of intricacy, recollection, depth, innuendo, the nod, the wink, the subplot that only appears every once in a while. So I start there. Secondly, then, one of the things I tried to do at the end of the book was just, here are some things you could that are very accessible that you could read that would get you in to below the surface really fast. And then obviously now, like with the internet, you can literally look up a Greek word. Oh, here's the word. Here's where else it's used. Like, all of this is as easy as booking air flights. So I know some people are like, well, you're in your book. I mean, I don't have that kind of time. You know what? Neither do I. and also, one of the interesting things, it's almost as if you don't have this muscle, you can build this muscle. Mm-hmm. So you learn to answer these questions, and in a quick amount of time, you can read something and be like, I have no idea, but you at least know, well, there's probably something to do with the geography. That's probably a reference to something. Within moments, you can have muscles that help you realize, at least now I know what I'm looking for. And away you go. So, yes, everybody can be in on this.
Rob, how did you decide what on earth to cover? I mean, You know, when you're looking at the Bible, it's not a small tome. I mean,
honestly, it started with, to me, what's in my head.
Mm. Mm.
What? Let me just start typing things I've come across over the years. So in some ways, it was an accumulation of 25 years of reading and studying this book. I actually had an exercise like, I need to free up RAM space, like in my head. It literally started with, well, that story, there's this going on. Well, that story, we know this about that story. And I just started typing. And it ended up, I mean, first draft was like 102,000 words.
Oof, and actually, sounds like a lot of words.
This book, honestly, is like an intro. Mm. It's like of the iceberg.
It very much felt that way.
And I purposely, oftentimes a book about the Bible is an attempt to tell you what it says. Here's what's in it. So then it becomes the energies are towards summation. Here's a summary. I'm actually in this book going the other direction.
Yeah.
I'm doing the opposite of summarizing. I'm trying to widen it. I'm trying to show you just how deep the pool is if you dive in. And I realized the only way to do that would just be to read it, almost like to read it publicly in the pages of of my book, and just invite you to read it with me, and perhaps something might happen. And then hopefully from there on, you can't read it the same way again.
I'm curious if there was a particular chapter that you wrestled with more than any other.
I probably just deleted that chapter.
No fair.
Actually, well, that's a great question. Actually, what it was is, I think originally there were 75 chapters. I think the final version has 43 chapters. Actually, it was an issue of, and a friend helped me who's very well versed in something called information architecture, which is, what is the architecture of this book? How do we arrange so much content?
Yeah.
Like, where does it start? Then where do we go? So I spent weeks just looking at all those different parts and looking for sequences, looking for themes, which is why it has that sort of Roman numeral one, Roman numeral two, is what are the biggest possible movements that I could take people through? And then that the questions at the end, I started thinking, if I was doing this as a live event and I stopped here, what are the questions that people would ask? And then the whole Q&A is like picturing a live event. What are the first questions people might ask? Genealogy, Leviticus, that kind of stuff.
Sure, that makes sense too. Hey, this is sort of a sideways off the wall question maybe, but as a wife, you know.
No such thing.
No, yeah. As a wife, I'm curious, do you talk through this stuff with Kristen? Do you, as you're writing a book, or are you just on your own doing your thing and, you know, when it's done, you hand it to her? I mean, it's because I know you've written books together. You guys wrote The Zim Zoom of Love, right?
We wrote one together, right? No, she didn't have anything to do with this one. It was actually became a running joke. She's like, I probably heard you say all of it anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe, right?
I mean, I think my first book was called Velvet Elvis in 2005. And she had like a huge, she's a very good editor.
Mm.
She had a huge hand in helping trim that up and give that some shape. But no, she's got her own thing going. So this has been a running joke. At one point I was like, seriously, don't read it. That's so cool. If it gets published and you haven't read it, that would be hilarious.
Right.
So she asked that because it was like a running joke in our house.
That's great. I love it. Well, John, I'll let you go if you have something specific before I get into the next thing.
One of my favorite lines in the book was that the Bible should start verses as opposed to end discussion. And on the what has quickly become one of my favorite podcasts, The Bible for Normal People with Pete Enns, they recently had on Amy Jill Levine, who's I think a Jewish scholar. And the question they asked her was, what can Christianity learn from Judaism? And she said very quickly, Christians need to learn how to disagree more.
I've heard you say that too, Rob, as a matter of fact, because you have a lot of, you have Rabbi Joel, he's a favorite of mine, on your podcast. But you've had other Jewish scholars or rabbis on, and that whole piece about disagreeing. But John, I didn't let you ask your question, but I love that.
I don't even think about it as disagreeing.
Well, she went on to qualify the rest of it, but basically being able to disagree and then, you know, at the end of the day say, you know, we're all part of the same family, right, sort of thing.
Yeah, what do you say, right, Rob?
Well, and specifically tie it up with the Bible should ideally start as opposed to end discussion.
Oh, right. Well, you think about the Protestant tradition, you know, still protesting after 500 years. The Protestant tradition in many ways located things in, well, what do you believe? Located it in cognitive assent, intellectual assent to things. What do you affirm? What do you deny? So the center for many people became, well, they have their 9 lists of things. They have their 11 statements of faith. We don't like theirs, so we're moving down the street, starting a new one. We take it more seriously, so we have 20. Then someone else comes along and says, oh, actually, we just love God and love people, so we only have 2. Well, what do you mean by that? So you just, as opposed to, well, I mean, you think about the Catholic tradition, you begin with Eucharist. Are you up for the body of bread or not? Or you think about in the Jewish family, we're part of a movement, we're part of a tribe, we're connected here. So you just begin, and then we're dancing with it. So I even love the way the rabbis speak of we're dancing with it. Mm-hmm. We're turning the gem. It's just a completely different... So the ego loves distinctions, because then it can cling to rightness, it can cling to orthodoxness, it can cling to its... The ego loves those little distinctions. Freud talked about the narcissism of difference, which is... If I can just find one little thing in which I'm different than you, oh, that feels so good. And actually, the closer then you are to somebody, the more the differences get amplified.
Yes.
Which to me is just, you'll hear about people going on and on about some denomination, and you'll think, do you understand that everybody but the 9 of you can't tell the difference between you and them?
That's great.
So... and even when you begin to read the Bible as a living, sacred, historic history and poetry and history, then you're just asking different questions. So you're just, oh, that's how you see it. Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like my friend Joel and I, we dance together. We have so much fun. We'll start riffing on something. We did a show a little while ago at a local comedy club with a comedian named Pete Holmes, the 3 of us. And it was so much fun, but I don't even think about it in terms of like, did you agree or disagree? What?
Sure.
What? What are you talking about?
But you
all went dancing.
That's a new way of thinking for a lot of people.
Well, it's just so much better.
Yeah, I like it. Yes. Yes.
Or you'll hear people say, well, you know, I wouldn't want them to think that I condone that. Where did you get the idea that everybody cares what you think? I wouldn't want them to think that I approve of that. Where did you get the idea that all we're all wondering about is what you think about everything? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It like masquerades as some sort of truth cause, and it's just a giant throbbing ego going, please tell me. It's just ridiculous.
That's a good line. I love the line. I wrote it down. The ego loves distinctions. That's a really good line.
I mean, names and distinctions can be very life-giving. I mean, at some degree, what I do is name things,
mm-hmm,
and make distinctions, but that's not form, it's spirit. There's also can be this spirit of desperately trying to make sure that everybody knows we're over here and they're over here, which is all just... Seriously.
So, which can I say this? One of the things that I... In fact, it's what I read first, interestingly enough. I always, you know, dig through a table of contents, and I immediately saw a note on growing and changing. Well, boom, that's where I went. And a couple of things. One, I loved that, to me, it felt like it was so kind-hearted and humble. That was the first thing that I felt as I read it. Because, and maybe it's because of where I've come from, where life hasn't always been kind-hearted or humble, you know, when you start kind of making a faith shift. But I loved the whole, that just feeds into what you just said, about the way to be in relationship with people. And you can't move someone. I mean, I couldn't be moved any direction until I was ready to go that direction. And that's, I'm not really stating it well, but
sure.
I loved this little piece in the book. Short, but lovely.
Yeah, you know, human consciousness is the great mystery. Why do some people respond and others don't? Why do some wake up, some don't? Why do two people hear the same exact thing and the one person says, oh my word, that changes everything, and the other person says, do you want to go get a burrito? And it's interesting, you even have these moments, it's almost as if Jesus says to his disciples at one point, hey, by the way, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to give this crowd some parables, and some of them are going to get it, and some of them aren't. Some of them, the lights are going to come on. Some of them are going to want to kill me. It's almost like as if Jesus says, and I don't even understand how it works. I don't even understand. And for many people, their understandings of spirituality were so shaped by the modern world and its mechanistic thinking, which was A plus B equals C. If you give people the truth with the right background music, lighting, and PowerPoint, then they'll respond however our mechanism has decided they'll respond, and then they'll come back for the 201 classes or whatever it is. But it's actually not how it works. And what's interesting is so few people were taught at the heart of all of this is human consciousness, and it's a deep mystery. And some people will not wake up. They are like soil that the seed simply can't find any purchase.
Ooh, where have I heard
and
that?
And I would argue it's actually at the center of everything Jesus is doing.
Wow.
And I would argue that a lot of the metaphors and parables that he uses as he's speaking about the mystery of human consciousness. And I think when he says, those who have ears to hear, but that doesn't fit well with modern conceptions, and so a lot of times those passages get interpreted other ways. I think that's actually what, and by the way, everywhere I go, this is what people want to talk about. Because people, they have seen something, and once you see, you can't unsee, and once you taste, you can't untaste. Mm-hmm. And so many people have seen something that their family system, tribe, partner, business, college roommates, neighbors, church friends haven't seen, and everything got bigger. It went from black and white to color. It's now way more dangerous and interesting. It's doing something beautiful into them that all the old stuff didn't do, and they weren't prepared for the fact that the moment of greatest joy for them would cause division with their tribe, and so they walk with a limp.
Yeah.
And then when you point out, oh, by the way, in the New Testament, the dominant question is, who's my family? Now do you see what they're talking about? Mm-hmm. They're not talking about atheists and whoever's persecuting you. They're talking about what happens when you're at odds with your own tribe.
Yes.
And a lot of people weren't taught this, because for the system to teach them that, the system would have to be saying to them, you might outgrow this system. And systems always bend towards their own preservation.
Right. I love that, actually, in your most recent or last couple of podcasts, Kingdom of Preservation and Kingdom of Denial.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Institutions, family systems, businesses generally veer towards self-preservation, and voices of dissent or resistance or critique, unless it's unusually healthy, will have to be quieted because we have a payroll we have to make.
This makes me want to cry. This just makes me want to cry.
Yeah. It's interesting when I talk about this, and this happens everywhere. The room, people just need, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then is when you do meet up with people who are on similar paths, those friendships become 1,000 times more valuable.
Yes.
And you realize all of these relationships that maybe you once had that just came from tribal affinity, but they didn't really have the depth and the life and the vigor that we all know is possible. Yeah.
Wow.
So true.
Yeah.
The really kind of the at the root of all this unfortunateness is as you said, that systems, you know, don't bend towards self-critique. Do you think there's a way to kind of healthily do that in a good way? That might be asking a little bit too much of the human race per se, but just curious for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, that's obviously, you now have, you know, great leaders. When you read about how they did, they were always people who were very open and aware and teachable, and you now have all sorts of people talking about this in business circles and in leadership circles, like, wait, how do we not become the thing that we all despise? I mean, obviously the power of the Bible is its capacity for self-critique, because generally history is told by the conquerors, who tell you how they crushed everybody in the name of their gods. And what's interesting in the Bible is it talks about the shortcomings and failures of its leaders, and it has this tremendous capacity to point the finger at itself, which is needed now more than ever.
Yeah, preach.
Exactly.
Preach on for a while on that. John, any? I've got a kind of a closing question. Do you have anything you want to get to before I go there?
Yeah, I do have one just final question. So one thing that you didn't talk about very much in the book, which probably just because it wasn't your focus, but you didn't talk much about the formation of the biblical canon, something how the Bible got to be what it is, because, you know, especially with the Apocrypha, you know, this is a whole other kind of select library that, you know, potentially has things to say about.
Sure.
And so I was curious why you chose not to talk more about that.
And can I interject a little sliver into that? So John comes
absolutely
home.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, thank you. So John comes home from college, and he had taken a New Testament class or something. I don't know. That's immaterial, maybe. Anyway, he goes, how have I not known this? How has no one... Why did no one preach on this? How did I not know how the canon of Scripture came to be? And what the deal? Anyway, so...
Yeah, one of the reasons is when I said, like, and then some people wrote these down and some people edited these stories and
right.
some people decided these were... Is that for me was all... If you really want to find that interesting, you can go find that out. But if you can begin with some people... made some decisions about what the Bible even is. That was my, that's what I wanted to do, is just let you know, yes, obviously somebody somewhere decided. So yeah, you can go find that. And there are people, you can go way down that rabbit hole if you wanted. Mm-hmm. What you will learn at the bottom of that rabbit hole is some people made some decisions.
Exactly.
And if you find those other books life-giving and wonderful, fantastic.
History buff. Go for it.
Yeah, fantastic. So that was totally intentional, partly because you used the phrase something of the canon, which nothing will stop a party faster than canon. Somebody even mentioned that. They're like, you didn't do a lot on canonization. And I said, yes, because you used the word canonization.
That's great. Way to go, John. I love that. Rob, what's your deepest hope? I mean, when you fling a book out there into the world, you know, you got to have, I'm guessing you've got some hope attached to it. What do you hope people walk away from this with after they read it?
There is this growing, pervasive lack of depth to our world. How many views did your YouTube channel get? And to me, I hope it's like a giant bass note. Mm-hmm. Feels like we're all trouble. For many people, the modern world is becoming more and more all trouble, no bass.
Mm-hmm. Illustration or that analogy.
Artificial intelligence was nerve gas used in Syria. Like, you have these pressing questions of technology, violence, consumerism. There's a billboard near my house. Amazon now has a billboard. Well, they'll deliver here in LA. They'll deliver within an hour. So they have a billboard that says from zero to happy in 1 hour.
Wow.
Now we're not even pretending.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. We're not pretending. We're just telling you, you're sad, we'll make you happy in under an hour if you buy things. Amazon's not even pretending anymore that we're selling you hope, or we're just, hey, happy, here it is. So to me, what I hope for this book is to give people a base note. Hmm. Oh, we've been here before. These new challenges, which are brand new, where we haven't been, underneath it will be fundamental human questions that people have been asking for thousands of years. But there's a depth that's desperately needed. Mm. Otherwise, you're just enslaved to this moment. Mm. And as it gets faster, and as it gets quicker, and as it gets... somebody sends you a video clip, and so you immediately look to see the timestamp. It's under 2 minutes. I might actually watch it. 4 minutes, forget it.
Wow.
I hope that this is a giant, resounding bass note of love and joy and peace and solidarity and absence as well as presence. All of these questions that feel like they're the most progressive, cutting edge, dangerous. The number of people who I'm starting a podcast to have a dangerous conversation.
Right.
You know, there's a line, Jesus is on the cross and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is the day that God becomes an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right. No discussion you're going to have is that.
Say that again. Exactly. Is that what? Is that? No discussion is that.
No discussion you're going to have is actually that dangerous.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's at the heart of faith all along. What other kind of questions? I just need a faith that can, what other kind of faith is there than a faith that can go into all the darkest places? So, yeah, base note. That's what I'm trying to give people.
I'm feeling.
And we're not playing the treble game anymore.
Well, yeah, and hopefully people get caught up in something. Oh, and then obviously there's this, my friend calls it a spectral presence. Hmm. If you read these ancient books, something's pulling the whole thing forward.
Hmm.
You, why does it have a forward movement? Why is the universe expanding and growing in complexity and depth and unity? Why do we not have slaves anymore? Why is something within us say that's wrong and we need to leave that behind? What is that within all of us that says, thank God we don't still do that, and yet at the same time, but wow, we have a long ways to go. What is that sense that we're somehow moving along something?
Yeah.
That's, I don't know what you call that, but.
It's good.
Here's hoping you'll podcast about it. Down the road. Rob, thanks. Could talk a long time with you, obviously. This has been a treat. Thanks for writing the book and for being with us on Faith Conversations. Kind of fun to do it with John, to have this
great
with him too.
So. Yeah, mother son, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, thank you. All right, folks.
Well, much luck.
Yeah, hey, back at ya.